From KMXT in Kodiak, this is the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Jennifer Canfield. Coming up this week, a pirate ship in Unalaska will be up for sale soon. User groups on the Sayu River near Yakutat clash over salmon allocations. Congress authorizes $1.7 million to dredge the entrance to Kodiak St. Paul Harbor. And Representative Alan Osterman touts coastal communities at a recent economic summit held in Anchorage. Those stories coming up on the Alaska Fisheries Report.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by Alaska Boats and Permits, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs. 1-800-992-4960 or online at alaskaboat.com.
5 months after its seizure, the stateless fishing vessel Bangoon Perkasa is still tied up at the dock in Unalaska. But not for much longer. Earlier this month, a U.S. District Court judge formally declared the vessel unclaimed. Now the government will seek forfeiture so the Bangoon Perkasa can be sold, either for scrap or at auction. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has more.
When the Coast Guard intercepted the Bangoon Perkasa on the high seas last year, the boat was setting a drift net. Frequently referred to as curtains of death, drift nets are indiscriminate in their harvest and detrimental to ocean ecosystems. They're also illegal on the high seas, so the crew of the Bangoon Perkasa tried to cut their net and flee the Coast Guard. Obviously, they were unsuccessful. The vessel was escorted into Unalaska and the crew deported to their home countries. But no country wanted to claim the Bangoon Perkasa, so the task of locating its owner fell to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Law Enforcement Office. Assistant U.S. Attorney James Barkley is responsible for the case against the vessel. He says it's been a long process.
Not only was the information about this case sent directly to the contact number provided by the master, but in addition, notice of the lawsuit itself and the steps that needed to be taken to join the case and claim the vessel were translated into Chinese, because that's the nationality of the crew, and published several times in the Asian Wall Street Journal, in a seafood trade journal, and even in the Anchorage Daily News.
Perhaps not surprisingly, no one replied. According to court documents, NOAA law enforcement also did some digging into the paper and money trails of the vessel, but that office said they couldn't comment on an ongoing investigation. So finding no owner, the government filed in early March for a default judgment against the vessel, essentially a formal declaration that no one had shown up to challenge the allegation of illegal fishing. A judge signed off on the motion, and as a result, the government can now seek forfeiture of the Bangoon Perkasa. Barkley says it's been a long time coming.
Not all of these cases end up being prosecuted in court, but the Bangoon Perkasa, for example, was spotted doing this type of fishing by the Canadian Air Force more than once in the last 4 or 5 years. And the resources were just not available at the time to get a boat out on the ocean and board the vessel. But we have every reason to think that the Bangoon Perkasa has been fishing illegally like this many more times than just this once when it was caught.
The trick now, Barkley says, is making sure it doesn't end up back on the streets, so to speak.
It's kind of like the maritime equivalent of a beater car, and we want to make sure it doesn't go back to the same line of work. That's why selling it for scrap is one attractive alternative under consideration.
Barkley says the sale is unlikely to generate a lot of money, regardless of whether it's sold for scrap or auctioned off as is.
Was discussed that this is not a multi-million dollar vessel and in all likelihood might cost some money by the time it was forfeited. But the decision was made that the gravity of the harm outweighed those expenses and also the message to the international community that we're not just going to let it go on. Because you see, if people knew that all they had to do was do this type of fishing and do it in a boat that wasn't worth dragging back, then they would know they would be able to get away with it.
NOAA spokesperson Leslie Bales-Sherrod says the total cost of keeping the boat docked in Unalaska since September has been $219,000. The Coast Guard covered the initial cost of de-ratting the ship and getting it port ready, which was estimated at $200,000. Sale of the vessel's catch netted NOAA $33,000, which is currently being held in an escrow account. Bales-Sherrod says the money for the vessel's upkeep will come out of NOAA's asset forfeiture fund and won't affect the agency's operating budget. Barkley says a decree of forfeiture will be filed in the next few weeks, at which point NOAA will be able to move forward with disposal of the vessel. In on Alaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Pebble Partnership. Listening before we act. Find out more at pebblepartnership.com.
A Yakutat area lodge owner has lost a battle over salmon allocations after it appeared that he had won. It's just one of the conflicts between user groups that came before Alaska's Board of Fisheries earlier this month. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Sayu River is a short, shallow waterway about 125 miles up the Gulf of Alaska coast from Yakutat. It has a strong coho run, so commercial fishermen have been setting their nets there for decades. The silvers also attract sport fishermen who stay at nearby backwoods lodges. That's led to some problems on the five-mile-long waterway.
And what I hope to do is to put a little separation between the user groups so there wouldn't be the conflict all the time.
Dan Earnhardt works for the Sayu River Coalition, which represents some lodges and their clients. He brought a proposal before the Board of Fisheries aimed at dividing up the river. The lower half would go to anglers, the upper half to set netters.
I wanted to do something that was fair, something that was right for both user groups, that would not interfere with the traditional uses of the commercial people, but yet giving a little more opportunity to the sport fishermen.
It really is unwarranted to most everybody who's involved.
That's Casey Mapes, who chairs the Yakutat Committee advising the Board of Fisheries on local matters. His group opposed the plan, or any version of it, saying it just wasn't needed. He got agreement from Yakutat's mayor, municipal government, tribal government, and fish processor, even one of the other Sayu River lodges.
You know, it's plenty of fish, the river's healthy, there's room, everybody usually gets along. It's just that you get a few people who have problems, and it winds up that everybody has to suffer for it.
The allocation plan went through a board committee. It switched the boundary, putting set netters in the lower half of the river. That proposal then went before the full board, where it was debated and finally passed on a close 4-3 vote. But as word spread to Yakutat, new information came in. It showed a higher number of people involved in the commercial fishery and a greater value of their catch. That led board member Mike Smith of Fairbanks to bring the proposal back for reconsideration. He had voted for it, but wanted the opportunity to change his mind.
These are long-time, historical, multi-generational fishing sites, Mr. Chairman. They're sites that are fished by hand. That is, they don't use boats. These people are conducting commercial fisheries by hand, Mr. Chairman. They're working that thing physically and have been doing so for generations.
He said the new boundaries would likely hurt set netters and others involved in the fishery. Board member Tom Kluberton of Talkeetna had a different view. He said the Yakutat Borough gets far more income from the lodges than from commercial fishing.
I think we're seeing a culture clash here. We're seeing traditional commercial methods clashing with a new economy that's been emerging in that vicinity.
Other board members questioned some of the new information, saying it was an exaggeration or a rehash of what was considered before. Board Chairman Carl Johnstone of Anchorage argued changing votes would set a bad precedent.
It just doesn't make sense to me. It looks like the board is going to, by a majority vote, say we have new information, revisit something that we fleshed out pretty thoroughly, and I don't think it looks good for the process.
The final count was 4-3 against the proposal. Smith was the one member to change his vote, leaving Sayu allocations as is. Two other river proposals were also before the board. One would have banned using powerboats to drive fish into nets. Another would have changed how the state sets commercial openings in the area. The Sayu River Coalition's Earnhardt, who authored the measures, withdrew his support. The board considered them anyway, but voted them down. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting.
You're listening to the Alaska Fisheries Report. Hear the whole show anytime online at kmxt.org.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
Senator Mark Begich announced last month the passage of a massive spending bill, which includes over $1.7 million to dredge Kodiak's St. Paul Harbor entrance. It's a project Harbor Master Marty Owen says he's been pursuing for 15 years. He says the funding has come in the nick of time, as the boats that use the harbor are just getting larger as the entrance gets shallower.
Well, you know, a lot of these Super 58s are getting wider and deeper every time we see a new one come in. It's more draft and more width. So as the boats get deeper and the harbor gets shallower, the two were bound to meet, and we're basically there.
Naturally, the one entrance to the harbor will need to be closed during blasting, and while active dredging of bedrock is underway, there are 250 ships in St. Paul Harbor, but many more boats use it on a regular basis, either at the water dock, Oscar's dock, or the tidal grid.
The size of the barge in there will determine whether how much access that we'll be able to have in and out of there. The Corps hasn't awarded a contract yet. The more restrictive we make it for the contractor to do the work, naturally, the more expensive it's going to be to get it done. On the other hand, we can't close down the harbor for the summer because a lot of businesses depend on getting in and out. So there has to be a compromise.
Owen said now that the Army Corps of Engineers has been awarded the money for the project, he will be sitting down with them to work on the closure details. He suspects the dredging could be done in a month.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is supported in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The majority leader in the Alaska House of Representatives stressed the importance of strong coastal communities during a speech at the recent Southwest Alaska Municipal Conference Economic Summit in Anchorage. KDLG's Mike Mason was there and filed this report.
Ellen Osterman is a former commercial fisherman and currently represents the Kodiak region in the Alaska House of Representatives. He served as a fisheries policy advisor to former Alaska Governor Frank Murkowski and also served in the Alaska Senate. His moving speech to the tribal, business, and municipal leaders from across Southwest Alaska was well received because in the speech he outlined the challenges facing fishing communities. Osterman says access to the fish resource is vital to the continued strength of Alaska's coastal cities and villages.
Today, we are fighting for our economic survival in so many areas, in so many fisheries, where people want to own the public resource instead of just fish to have access to it.
Some of the most significant changes that have impacted the fishing lifestyle and fishing communities in Alaska have come from the federal government due to efforts to privatize the federal fisheries around Alaska. Osterman says the privatization effort has in part been driven by corporate greed.
I use the word greed, and it's pitted fishermen against fishermen. It's pitted communities against communities as people race for ownership of the resource rather than the right to fish.
Osterman told the assembled leaders from Southwest Alaska that they must continue to fight for access to the fish resource, and he cautioned that it's going to continue to be a struggle to maintain the fishing lifestyle that many Alaskans have become accustomed to. Perhaps the most moving part of Osterman's speech came right at the end when he acknowledged the challenges facing fishing communities and the Alaska fishing lifestyle.
I see the efforts and the need to be as efficient as we can possibly be to fit our fishing resources into the global needs of the world. The task is to fit our fishing culture into those global views.
Alan Osterman is well positioned to advocate for Alaska coastal communities through his position as the majority leader in the Alaska House of Representatives and his long-standing ties to the commercial fishing industry. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you by commercial fishermen for Bristol Bay, permit holders and fishing groups standing together to protect and enhance the renewable fishing jobs and businesses of the Bristol Bay region.
And that's all for this week's edition of the Alaska Fisheries Report. We had help from KUCB's Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld, KDLG's Mike Mason in Dillingham, and KMXT's Jay Barrett in Kodiak. Also in Kodiak, I'm Jennifer Canfield.